Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sweater Weather. I'm Aaron Giovannoni, a writer and professor.
I'm Naomi Lewis, a writer and editor.
And I'll introduce our wonderful guest in a moment. Just a little bit about our show. Sweater Weather is a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. In long format discussions, we dive deep into Canadian literature, film, music, television. What else is there in terms of art? We haven't done dance. We haven't done dance or fine art, but maybe one day. The show is available on all major video, audio, and social media platforms, so you can follow us there. Also, check out our Eventbrite page for upcoming live shows like this one. This episode of Sweater Weather is recorded before a live audience at the Memorial Park Library in Calgary, on Treaty 7 territory, home of the Siksika Nation, the Piikani Nation, the Kainai Nation, the Ithka Stoney Nakoda Nation, the Tsuut'ina Nation, and the Métis people of Alberta Region 3. Sweater Weather is made possible by the support of the Calgary Public Library. Thank you, Library, for having us here, Calgary Arts Development, and the Alberta Foundation for the Arts, and of course our audience. So if you do enjoy what we're doing here, consider making a donation to the show on Patreon or PayPal. Your individual support is important to sustaining the show and is very much appreciated. Our topic today is Ducks, the celebrated graphic memoir by Cape Breton artist Kate Beaton. The book tells the story of her 2 years working in the Alberta oil sands between 2005 and 2008. Ducks is a New York Times bestseller. Publishers Weekly named it a top 10 book of the year. It recently won the Canada Reads competition. It was recommended by President Obama. And it is now a topic of a Sweater Weather episode. Can you? The honors keep rolling in. Here to talk to us today about Ducks is the wonderful Mark Herman Lynch.
Yeah.
Mark's gonna get two rounds of applause, I think. Mark is the author of the 2020 novel, Arborescent. He is currently completing a PhD in English at the University of Calgary, and he is a comics enthusiast, having written one of his own for a while. I do remember this, having known Mark for a while. So please welcome Mark Lynch. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
How do you, what's your experience with Kate Beaton's work?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that I did write a comic because I'd almost forgotten about it. And so when you were asking me for biographical information, I was like, yeah, whatever you got is fine. Yeah. But yeah, I used to write a comic called Autosomna with a friend of mine, Lars Hedlund, who was the artist in it. Yeah, and it was published in The Gauntlet, and we also had a sort of webcomic with it.
Oh, yeah.
And so when we were doing that, I kind of started getting into like the webcomic vibe.
Yeah.
Right? So
Kate
I had
Beaton
to like
was big in that space.
Huge in that space, yeah. Right? So it was like Penny Arcade, which had its own kind of focus around, you know, video game culture, right? And it was XKCD, which was like focused around esoteric scientific knowledge and stuff like that. And then Kate Beaton took on the sort of esoteric historical figures, so to speak.
Right.
I put that in quotes because she says that. That's her kind of main draw.
Right, right. So you knew her work from back then. What do you know about Kate Beaton? I'll go over all your first impressions.
I just knew her from Hark a Vagrant, her comics that I would see online.
Yeah.
And also like in, I think they appeared in like free weeklies and stuff, right? Like.
So you saw them there?
Yeah. I remember them just kind of being around forever.
Okay. Yeah.
And very funny and lovely. And I actually didn't make the connection until recently that it was the same person.
Oh, really?
It's so different. It's so different from what she does in Ducks. Like Hark a Vagrant is so light and funny and historical and not personal and not contemporary, and so even the drawing style is like less detail, much less detailed and less realistic and stuff. So
right,
I hadn't really realized that it was the same person.
Right.
I was also thinking about, sorry, I know we always do this thing where we talk about where we first encountered the topic.
Yeah.
But I was always also thinking about like where I first encountered the topic of the oil sands. Can we talk about that?
Sure.
Because like I grew up in Ontario and I didn't really know, like it's weird, but I barely knew what, we called it the tar sands and I barely knew what it was. Like I really had no idea what was going on in Alberta. And to this day, like I've mentioned the oil sands to my American relatives, like they do not know about it. So I find it just so interesting that here in Alberta, it's like so ubiquitous and so a part of life that we talk about. And we've all seen like images and know people who've worked there probably. I've certainly known people who've worked there. And, but just to like a little bit further afield, like maybe it's probably not true anymore at all, but like even within Canada and certainly outside Canada, people just do not know that much about it. So I find that interesting. And that's why like part of the reason this book seems important is it's actually telling people about something they don't know.
Yeah. I think the book actually relates a moment when the oil sands came into bigger public consciousness,
right?
Like the title referring to it, Ducks. There was an incident where it was reported widely in the New York Times. 500. Everybody here probably knows this. 500 ducks died when they after they landed in a tailings pond, and that became an international story.
And then there was Keystone XL.
And this is around 2008.
Like Keystone XL really brought the oil sands into like the like sort of a popular environmentalist, like what's the word?
Discourse
and. Like there was a lot of activism that was aimed at that particular pipeline, and that really brought the tar sands or like dirty oil or whatever like into public consciousness.
Right. Yeah, I didn't know anything about Kate Beaton. I mean, I was in school way too long,
same with me.
Yeah, you live a cloistered life, and it's like, what is my dissertation about? Oh yeah, it's about an obscure modernist Italian poet. I have to go into the archives to find out about him. But Kate Beaton, it's like in, it's on the internet. On the internet, it's on LiveJournal, it's like in free weeklies. Had I noticed Kate Beaton? Nope, totally missed it. And so I had heard, like in the last few years, people, every now and then someone would mention Kate Beaton. I'd be like, oh, yeah, never, I don't know her, but I should check her out. And then this book came out last year and was such a sensation that I finally could not avoid Kate Beaton any longer. And so I dove in. And then Ducks was my first experience of Kate Beaton. And in research for this episode, going back and looking at her older comics, Hark a Vagrant, which was published from 2007 to 2018, I too was struck by, oh, this is very different. Like I see the evolution and why it would have happened the way it did, but it is quite different. And so it is an interesting evolution as an artist. So this is a memoir. So we're going to learn a lot about Kate Beaton just by talking about the book, going through sort of some of the main events. Spoiler alert for anybody. I mean, if you're here already and you're like, oh, I don't want spoilers, like, sorry, we're going to tell you the whole book. but we don't need that much background about Beaton because so much of it is in the book already, but there are a few things to say. She's from Mabou. Is that how you say it? Mabou, Cape Breton.
Mabou?
Mabou.
That's how it's spelled.
Oh man, people online are getting mad at us already. Okay, so she has three sisters. Her father was a butcher in a grocery store and her mother worked at a credit union. That does show up in the book. Her sister Becky, who is actually a prominent character in the story, an older sister, she died of cervical cancer in 2018 when she was just 36. And Kate Beaton wrote a New York Times opinion article about her, about why she may have died, and suggests that there was like some medical, misguidance involved. Kate Beaton studied history and anthropology at Mount Allison University. She started drawing cartoons first for the school paper, the Argosy. We know that she goes to Fort McMurray to pay off her student loans afterwards. She starts publishing her comics on the web while she is in Fort McMurray, first on LiveJournal, then on her own website. Her own Hark a Vagrant, as it's eventually called, is published from 2007 to 2018, and this is what makes her reputation. She won several cartoonist awards in that period. She was published in all the big magazines like Paris Review and The New Yorker and Wired. These are very funny strips. We've talked about them already. There's like a character from history or fictional characters from literature. And it's just like a little ditty, a funny little ditty on a like very quirky interpretation of what life would have been like. They're funny, but I do see why. And she published two book collections of Hark a Vagrant. We have one of them here. Step Aside, Pops. That's a Hark a Vagrant collection by Kate Beaton. I see why she had to move away from this, despite just the fact that if you're an artist, you get tired of doing the same thing over and over again, and you do have to evolve your practice. I also understand. Like, I also get the sense that the sensibility of Hark a Vagrant wouldn't work that well today. And every now and then something clangs. Like, for example, having like a lighthearted, humorous take on Canadian prime ministers of the past. I just think people are more aware of sort of the crimes of history in public discourse, and so it's kind of harder to talk in a lighthearted, funny way about historical characters, I think. And so I can see why she wouldn't want to stay with that, and she's moved into Ducks, what she does in Ducks, which we'll get into. She's published two children's books as well, The Princess and the Pony and King Baby. Loving that name, King Baby.
That's hilarious already.
These are both mainstream successes. And in fact, last year, there was an Apple TV series based on The Princess and the Pony. It was called actually The Pinecone, or Pinecone and the Pony? The Pinecone and the Pony. They renamed it for some reason. That was on Apple TV, and that was also the same year that Ducks came out and was such a sensation. So big, big, big year for her last year. She's lived, you know, during her career in New York and Toronto. She now lives back home where she was born, you know, with her family in Mabou, Cape Breton. Her husband is novelist Morgan Murray, and they have two children. So I looked up her husband, Morgan Murray, and he wrote a book. The names has escaped me, but it's a book about, it's fictional and it's comic, and it's about a man kind of like a basement dwelling kind of like loser guy who like goes to Montreal because he wants to emulate the life of Leonard Cohen. And it struck me immediately, like, oh my gosh, I kind of half did that myself. So I both want to read that book, and I'm also very scared of doing
but
it.
But you were like 18 when you did that.
I don't know if this involves going to university or something. I'm not really sure what the book is. But it was a selection or a long list selection for Canada Reads at some point too. So that's her husband, Morgan Murray. So let's get into Ducks. Why don't we? Okay, so this book's in sections, right? And it's divided into sections according to where Katie is in any given moment. So it begins in Cape Breton with this opening section that contextualizes economic life in Cape Breton. And here you see her pulling on her experience writing about history for Hark a Vagrant. So there's like a little history lesson with some like vistas of the coast while we see like just the story of Cape Breton. And the people there, their lives involving leaving, having to go work elsewhere because all of the local industry has over time, you know, gone. So coal mining and the fisheries especially. And this is a quote, Katie, as she's often called in the book, she says, "I learn that I can have opportunity or I can have home. I cannot have both." So, do you want any comments on the opening section of the book? What are you guys thinking?
Well, yeah, she addresses like the economic reality of living in a depressed location. Cape Breton, kind of the whole Maritimes, like was in that situation a little bit. And, you know, like half the people in Fort McMurray were like famously from Newfoundland or Maritimes. And she also addresses like student debt. And how, you know, her parents are like, well, you went and got this degree. Like, the next logical step is to get a job from your degree. And, like, she's like, that's not really the reality. And now I just have to do whatever I can to pay off this debt as fast as I can. And, like, my BA is not going to really get me a job. And so, like, I really appreciated how, like, it brought that reality to light. Like, that's true for so many people, not just in Cape Breton, like everywhere in Canada and the States, obviously, like you get saddled with debt and you don't actually have like a degree that's gonna get you a job in the field that you allegedly are trained in.
If you took anthropology and history.
And the arts,
The arts generally. Yeah, I mean, this is an experience, I mean, that I had too. I mean, I was the first in my family as like Kate's parents did not go to university, and it signaled that, you know, they're very regional and they're not like university educated by the way that they speak. Like the mother speaks like ungrammatically. She says, that's why I wanted yous to get an education. So like she's trying to make us show this difference in education and culture from herself and how
and the dialect of
it's a dialect of the region too, right? And why her parents didn't really understand like her situation, because they just thought if you got a degree, you'd get a job. And that's just how it worked. And it's indeed what, you know, that's what my mom thought too.
Yeah.
But she hadn't gone to university.
My parents had gone to university and they still thought that.
Okay.
So. What about you? What did you think of the beginning of the book?
I thought it was interesting because the rest of the book is not organized like that. So it sets up very, very clearly that this is a graphic memoir. I think at one point in time, she even says that this is my two-dimensional representation, right? And then it goes in, so it's actually very much distanced from the rest of the book, almost like a prologue, in the fact that it shows her talking about herself and putting us in this context,
right,
that we then get thrust into the actual narrative of it. And it's very streamlined. It doesn't have that sort of prologue-y, self-reflective kind of an analytical structure. So that's the only time we actually have it, right? Throughout the rest of the book, at least as far as I can remember.
She appears as a narrator.
Yeah.
She appears as a narrator. I'm going to tell you about Cape Breton. And that actually doesn't happen elsewhere. She's just otherwise a character in the story. We get a sense of what's at stake. She says, I'm not going to stay in Alberta forever. But then a reply from, I think, one of her maybe it's her dad or a friend of her dad is, there's too many who have said that. So, you know, what's at stake here in these opening pages is that it does really have a family she loves and belongs to this place, and she loves Cape Breton and is of this place. She has to leave, and will she come back? Mm-hmm. And so this is the challenge that she's going to have to meet, I think, while making enough money to pay her student loans. And as we understand very soon, staying safe. Yeah. And that's not easy, where she's going.
Actually, even just to build on that, just real quick.
Sure.
So another one of the reasons I think I was invited to do this, I don't know. Right. Other than the fact that I'm so clever. but it was because I grew up in Fort McMurray.
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up. Like, we forgot to mention that.
Perfect segue.
This is important. And both my parents, so my father came from France and my mother came from Hong Kong, and they met in the University of Alberta, and then they went to Fort McMurray, and it's very much the same type of thing of, oh, you'll be back. Oh, no, you won't, right? You're going to be living. And actually, one time my mother did say this, and I hope I'm not giving her away or anything like that. She actually did say, it's like, our roots are in the oil sands. And I'm like, what? Is that really where our roots are? This seems too sticky.
So did your parents work like in that industry?
And my father was an engineer for Syncrude and then Suncor, right? And so he was up at the camps all the time.
Oh, wow.
And my mother was an accountant for a firm that worked with either Syncrude or Suncor, right? So.
Okay.
So did you personally spend time like at all in the camps or in the locations that Kate Beaton writes about?
Never. I just remember my father waking up at around 5 a.m, right, in order to get the bus, right, that came right outside our house in order to then get driven up to the camps. Mm, right. Wow. So
he was working in the camps, but he'd come home to town.
Yeah, exactly.
Generally. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And he'd come back home every night.
It's a distinction that matters a lot in this book, actually, when we see how Kate's, you know, life and career, if you can call it that, in Fort Mac is going. So we arrive in Fort Mac. There's a series of frames, like snapshots, that establish the setting. We get like the town sign. We've got the energy is the motto of Fort McMurray. Yes. We get another important landmark, Tim Hortons. There's also a variety club named Diggers. Jacked up pickup trucks, casino, Baptist church, a mosque, a restaurant named Newfoundlanders. And actually, Kate will get a job at Newfoundlanders. I think that's the restaurant she's working at. She's a server. The existing waitress there, she mentions, the guys go through money like air. So there's a lot of tips to be had working in Newfoundlanders. And so again, I think the stakes are heightened. Again, this is a place where you make a lot of money, but already we learn people don't hang on to their money. It's not so easy to hang on to it in a place like this. And soon enough, she's working at a what's called a tool crib. So she does get a job on a, like not in the camp, like on a site. I think it's pretty soon we go there. I forget what, Syncrude. It's a Syncrude Mildred Lake site. So she has to take the bus like your dad did. She was getting up at six to catch a bus up there. I don't know, what else should I say about this? When she's arriving, this is a shot you often get in representations of Fort McMurray, the dreadful terror, the surprise of the skyline of one of these sites. So you get like the Syncrude Mildred Lake skyline and it's smoke and fire and it's quite, and she's like scared.
I read in an interview with her that she actually like used photographs to draw those scenes. Like she just copied the photographs basically because in order to get all those details, like there's really no other way to do it. Cause it's like those drawings are so complex of that like sprawling landscape of like mines and equipment and,
right.
Yeah, like totally strip mined landscape.
Yeah.
That's the word.
Yeah. Hellscape.
Well, it certainly looks bad, yeah.
It doesn't, yeah.
But it's interesting because it's also painted very beautifully. Right?
Yes.
It's actually, it has a lot of beauty as well.
Yeah, that's a contrast that comes up several times. The sense that, yeah, like this is a... The work site, the camp, is dirty, it's polluted, but then there's the aurora borealis, there's a rainbow, there's a buffalo. All of these contrasting images of beautiful nature.
But even like the crazy mind surface of what looks like another planet like has its own weird, otherworldly kind of beauty. Like that's kind of, yeah.
Well, I mean, like the three-legged fox that kind of appears throughout.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's like a part of the sublime, right? The sublime has always had that scary part to it, right? Where it's beauty, it's immensity. It could be like scary, craggy mountains that when you see them, you're worried, you're scared because you might fall. Like that's kind of part of the experience of the sublimity of nature. Mm. And you have that here too, in a way that it's like the how it's a scary side of this like
industry
and
like the trucks that are as big as houses,
the heavy haulers. Again, there's another, it's not here, it's a little bit later, but encountering for the first time just those immense trucks where you stand beside the wheel and the wheel is two times taller than you. Just the wheel. And so there's many moments like that here, and there is a kind of sublime experience encountering industry at that scale and at that level of destruction, which is actually kind of scary.
Actually, just a quick side note,
Those
tires, right?
Yeah.
I remember when I was going to Clearwater Elementary School, our playground was built of those tires, right? So we had a playground full of just those tractor tires that were just painted colorful colors.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was actually pretty cool.
I feel like a whole grade four class could fit inside one of those tires.
And they were stacked on top. And they were stacked on top of each other like a tower, and then we would kind of like hide inside, and then we... It's great.
And that's the cover of the book is like Kate Beaton climbing a staircase to get into one of those trucks.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. That's right. So her first job there is working in a tool crib, which is basically you're in a trailer and all these the small tools and accessories are there. And it's her job to take inventory, to clean them and to lend them out to the workmen, mostly men, who come in asking for them. And it's while she's training there that she gets her first, I guess you'd say, like her first obvious douse of misogyny. She overhears a few guys, you know, talking about her within earshot. They're calling her cutie, little miss. They talk, you know, amongst themselves about chicks. And she's gritting her teeth hearing this. And this is just the beginning.
Yeah, so like she talks about how working there, it's like 50-1 men to women. And when there's a woman, it's just like this novelty and all the men just are like they line up to come and look at her and stuff. Like the first day she's at work, there's a line of men and they're like literally lining up just to like get a look at her.
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't get it. Like I'm not much to look at. I'm just like, she's just like, just being female is all it takes, right? To get this constant like creepy unwanted attention. And that attention ranges from just someone kind of looking at you to like sexual assault, constant harassment that she experiences. And I mean, it's funny because like some of the reviews of this book like barely talk about that part of it, but it kind of feels like to me like the main point or the like it kind of overshadows everything else, like the experience of being the only woman or one of the only women among men who are haven't seen a woman and who knows how long and are in this hyper masculine lonely space, and how a lot of men end up behaving. Is that something that you remember from Fort McMurray, or that your father ever talked about, or that people talked about?
I mean, mostly, so actually I didn't experience it because I left when I was about 13, 14, so I probably didn't have enough of a sense of it. But my sister actually also worked on, so she did work in one of the same mines that actually Kate Beaton did. And she worked in that mine 7 to 8 years after the fact. But she talks a lot about, for example, the importance of code switching that I think Kate Beaton showcases in this book, where, for example, and she, this is my sister, quoting my sister, she said that you had to develop a brutally and clever way of actually being able to deal with these people, right? Otherwise, what ends up happening is that you just be kind of overrun by these sort of misogynist comments. And my sister talks about, you know, one time being the only educated person in the room of 15, 16 people, right? And they kind of just told her, oh, you're the woman here, so you're taking notes, right? You're the secretary. So yeah, it's funny, even though she was in a little bit of a higher place than Kate Beaton because she did environmental sciences. Uh-huh. So even though she was in a little bit higher place, she was not protected from that kind of stuff.
Right, right, right.
And there's even a strange dynamic early on where Kate's immediate supervisor is an older woman. And this woman is trying to set her up with one guy in particular. His name's Radar. He's like a nice enough guy, but he's much older than her. So Kate Beaton's supervisor is like, well, what's the big deal? He's a nice guy. Like, she kind of is mean about it. Like, you think you're too good to go out with these guys? So there's like not even really having an ally there.
Yeah.
Not someone who she doesn't understand. It doesn't seem to understand.
Yeah, and Kate Beaton, like the character Katie keeps saying, you know, like this guy doesn't really like me. There's just no other women here. Like there's no connection between us. It's just that I am female and there's no one else around.
The quotation is this: all you need here is to be a woman. You stick out and that's all it takes. But that doesn't make me feel good. That makes me feel like I'm not even a person. So that's how she tries to explain herself to her supervisor, who's not, like, she's like trying to understand and listen, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. She doesn't respond anyway. I'm not really sure. So
yeah.
Why? Yeah.
Well, she kind of is like, well, you don't have a boyfriend, so like, here's your chance to get one, kind of.
Yeah. more. Yeah. More terrible conversations with men. A guy propositions her. Pretty, like, it's kind of in a scary kind of way that's offensive. And then he says, I'm summarizing, well, oh, I hope you're not like that last girl who worked here, who she would complain about stuff like this and she got people fired about it. So like, but you're cooler than that, right? Like after having said something pretty, pretty gross to her. Anyway, she's still working her waitressing job. And this is where we get a sense of like what's so important, what's actually going to be a saving grace in many ways for Kate there is her connection with East Coasters, especially Cape Bretoners, but also Newfoundlanders. So I think it's some Newfoundlander guys who come in and that she's serving them and they're actually nice and they're not creepy. And they get her, it's a group of guys, but they're okay. And they get her a lead at a better tool crib job. Same job, better site, maybe more pay, better hours. She's feeling good about this, goes outside to walk home. Four guys in a truck cat call her immediately. And it's like that totally ruins the vibe, the positive vibe she was on. you're getting the sense that there are three kinds of guys that were that like so far. There are the guys who hit on her. There are the fatherly types who are not hitting on her and are just nice. And then there are nice guys who are interested and but just kind of trying in a respectful way. That's kind of the three kinds. But that's the sort of and she gets along especially with East Coasters.
East Coast. She becomes part of that kind of community. But then there's also this like interesting distinction made between like people from Nova Scotia and people from Newfoundland and how it's like variations on a theme, but definitely different cultures.
Yeah, one has cod, one has lobster.
Yeah, one has accordions and one has fiddles.
Yeah, wasn't it accordions versus fiddles or something? Wasn't that it as well? Right. So she's on the shift of all Newfoundlanders and she's like fitting in with them pretty well. There's like younger guys and older guys. One of the older guys is named Ambrose and he has this moment where he chastises all the younger guys who are, they're bragging about having a ski-doo and having a big truck and having just bought a house. And he's like, you should not be spending your money like this because this is not going to last. And they're like, oh, whatever, let us have some fun, Ambrose, you old guy, whatever, you don't understand us. And then he's like, well, remember the Grand Banks of fishing? That was never going to end either. And they're like, oh, the Grand Banks. What, is this fish now? And he's like, ah, forget it. But Ambrose is sort of the guy, the older guy who Kate gets along with better. But at this new site, sexual danger is also increasing. And also just the sense of general danger, like on the bus there, a car goes off the road and someone dies. And it's like the bus, right in front of the bus, and the bus driver's like, oh, we got another one calling in. Who's gonna call it in this time? Like talking to someone else, like over his radio. And it's like, oh, this happens so often that it's just run of the mill. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's another kind of danger that's, like, this is an industrial work site and it's in the north and it's, like in the winter, especially.
Isn't that like it's called the Highway of Death?
The Highway of Death is what it's nicknamed. The highway that's going through this area.
Yeah, actually, my father, I think like their first purchase my father and my mother made was a new Volkswagen Beetle, right?
Uh-oh.
And I think it was a week old, and my father fell asleep.
In Fort McMurray?
In Fort McMurray.
Oh my gosh.
And he fell asleep at the wheel and rolled it.
Oh no.
A week in, and I don't think they had insurance at that time, so.
Was that on the Highway of Death?
That was on the Highway of Death.
It seems, I'm just picturing this little bug going along and like these giant trucks.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
The heavy haulers like driving by.
Anyways,
so it's she has some like other like women like friends who are women as well. They go out to a club together, and it's like, it's not. Kate's not really connecting with them necessarily, but she has again a talk with Ambrose, the elder Newfoundlander, who says he says this: we all live in two places here, and we can get caught up in it in our own way, meaning that. Kate, like you can pretend like you don't really live here. That is, she's not really making friends. She doesn't seem to be trying. She's thinking, I'm not here for long. But there's a danger in that, in not being aware of the place and not really in some ways like committed and aware, because that is important, of what's happening where you are, that can have its own sorts of dangers.
And you know, it's funny because you're talking about danger and like the sexual danger and all the danger around her, but like for the longest time in the narrative, I felt like she was more just kind of annoyed than scared.
Yeah.
Like she rolls her eyes a lot and she's like, oh, these guys and you know, like this culture is ridiculous, or this lack of culture, this weird like situation that I'm in and these people are so boorish or whatever, but she doesn't really seem to feel as scared as like I was imagining I would in that situation. She's just kind of like feels like, yeah, she's half there and half not, and she just has to get through it. And
And
the real threat doesn't really quite seem to penetrate for a while.
There's some there's this Dante-esque journey happening actually, where she's going deeper and into the oil fields and like encountering more and more danger along the way. And that's seems to be her process so far. So she just wants to make as much money as possible, understandably. If you go and live in a camp, they pay your bills for you. You don't have to pay rent or food, and you get paid more. So it's like you can make a lot more money living in camp. So Kate decides to take a camp job. But this also means that you live in cramped quarters, like in a trailer, with among a room amongst many, many men. And you know, and it, there's advice from a cab driver who's dropping her off there. He says, "You be careful, young girl. Do you know how people treat a place where they don't live?" Mm. It's immediately, this place is full of strangers. She's immediately being catcalled and harassed, just walking through to her room. She, there's a scene where, I mean, there's a frame where she checks the lock on her door, and you're like, it's just that little door, like the door handle lock.
Yeah.
And you're like, there's no deadbolt.
And when she's sleeping, like, people rattle the door trying to get into her room. Like,
yeah.
It's horrifying. How many of you have read the book, by the way?
Yeah.
Not very many.
Oh, no. All right.
Well, you should. It is a wonderful book. It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. What's happening here? Oh, yeah. Kate is, she hears the story of a wrecking ball operator who was on cocaine and snapped the ball right off of the chain. So Kate discovers that drugs, cocaine especially, is a big problem. Marijuana stays in the system and will show up in a drug test, but cocaine will not. So the irony of this drug testing policy of the era was that it actually incentivize people taking the hard drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, like, having all this money, right? Like, I remember people talking about that a lot, about working there. It's just like, there's no, like, hardly any women. You're, like, alienated and bored. And yeah, like, you're spending your money on, like, skidoos and, like, cars and stuff, but also on cocaine, for sure. Like, that was, like, a, I mean, just to, like, get through the workday, but also, like, kind of out of boredom.
Yeah.
And also, you have all this money, so, like, something that might seem like a extremely expensive habit becomes, like, not that big a deal. But then, like, you're there allegedly to save money, but then suddenly, like, all your money's gone.
Kate goes to a strip club. Why? Because it's the only thing anybody's doing. So, like, some friends, some of a guy friends, some of them, like, Mike is one of them. She becomes, like, pretty decent friends with. They go to the strip club together and, like, okay, this is something to do. It's not a lot of fun for her. She's getting ogled and harassed at her workstation quite a bit. She asks her manager if she could not work at that same station again, and she gets in trouble. So she has this conversation with her manager saying, like, they're, like, harassing me there. I don't want to do that job. And he's like, you have to do what you're told, like everybody else, and, quote, we're a team here, so you all have to be a team player, and just, like, shames her into going back to the job. And she's apologetic. She really feels it works on her. And that will come back later, but that's the sexual harassment institutional policy. Like, that's how it's treated, right, in practice when it comes up.
Yeah, of course. And then meanwhile, she, you know, her parents are saying, why don't you come home? And she's like, okay, like, I could go home, or I could even just go home and visit, and that would cost me all the money I've made so far.
Yeah.
So, like, so much for paying off my student loans and so much for there being any point in being here. So she can't even, like, go home for Christmas or whatever.
That's right. She stays over Christmas.
Yeah.
And I also want to, like, part of the, okay, this book, it does proceed, as I said, it is kind of, at least part of it is, like, this descent into hell, a certain kind of hell. And so as I'm recounting the major events, I'm talking about all the bad things that are happening. But you can tell she's really trying to leaven this, because it's making it sound really sad. I mean, it is a serious book, but there's lots of funny moments in it. Like, I mean, she's a skilled cartoonist. She was like, I mean, Hark of Vagrant was about the gag, the quick gag. And there's a lot of, like, not gags exactly, but just one page where she has a funny, quirky, like, conversation with one of her coworkers, and it's like a nice moment of humanity, of human connection. And that there's a lot of that throughout. But of course, the propulsion of the narrative is about worse and worse things happening to her. So that's kind of what you end up focusing on when you do summarize the plot here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really interesting style, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not. It is done very much so. For example, Hark a Vagrant is three panels. Right. And much like, for example, the Sunday comics.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it's six panels. Right. And you'll have a little bit more of a story. But most of the time you'll have that punchline. She does that same type of thing. But most of the time it's actually nine panels. Right. Mm-hmm. Or it's nine panels, one page, or she'll do two pages. And that's a quick scene. And from that beginning to end, it's not necessarily a punchline, but there's some kind of, like, narrative profluence. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, it does go from scene to scene that way, where, like, it's like after that page is over, then that scene is done. And then there's no, like, without a transition, there's a new scene, right?
That's right, yeah. So she, at camp, she's friends with a couple of guys in particular. I think it's Mike is one I've mentioned already. He likes to knit. They hang out playing video games. There's another guy, Brian. And they're like her friends there. But again, you feel like she's not super connecting with them, but like they're like good enough.
Yeah.
Like it is a bit sad. You're like, Mike seems like a good guy, but he doesn't get it. Like we'll be talking about something they really have a disconnect on in a minute. But there just aren't many options for her there. And so a good enough half boyfriend sort of is what she can is the best she can do.
Someone to hang out with.
Someone to hang out with. So she's invited at one point to a party with a woman friend. Her name's Trish and her boyfriend, Jace. All the names have been changed from what I understand.
Yeah.
She changed everybody's names. These are based on real people, but not the real names. At the party, an unnamed man, he remains anonymous and we never know who he was, lures Kate into her room and locks the door and it sexually assaults her. This is represented by, is it three or four black
panels, yeah.
Black panels. So we don't see what happens, but we obviously have a sense of it. This was a man who was just going to leave camp the next day. And so he had nothing to lose and no accountability, I guess. We are getting to the true bottom of that, this descent into hell, but we're not out of it yet. We're going to stay there for a little bit.
But after that happens, we just see her like sitting on the floor of her room and just kind of sitting there stunned. And then it's almost as though it didn't happen for the longest time. Like she doesn't tell anybody. She doesn't refer to it again. It just happens. And then like much like in real life, like she doesn't know what to do. And she just kind of puts it aside for the longest time.
What happens is she tries to tell those friends of hers, Mike and Brian, the video game playing fellas. And she tells them that she was raped. And they're like, what? No, it wasn't rape, was it? Oh, you were drunk. Oh, that was probably. So they don't like affirm her story.
Yeah, that's right. They just
and these are her
reality.
These are her friends, right? So they don't like they're not there for her. And she's actually humiliated further. You see the way she's drawn. It's actually very heart-wrenching. She's traumatized. She has PTSD. She's depressed. She's tired. She can't get up for work. People are like, what's wrong? Like at work, they're like, what's wrong with you? You're not listening. She has PTSD. And she's slowly realizing it, but isn't able to talk about it with anybody. So really isn't able to come to terms with it. And this puts her in an even more vulnerable state. She goes to a party again. And again, is aggressively pressured. She's raped again.
Again. It's almost like so horrible, that part, that after I read that, I was like, did that really happen? Like it happened twice?
This time it's by a man who works there, sticks around, and we will encounter him again later. Yeah. He continues to work for the company. This is depicted as Kate dissociating. So she walks out of her body and onto a Cape Breton shore to escape mentally.
Yeah, and she's thinking like, but this just happened. It can't be happening again.
Yeah.
And as a reader, you're kind of thinking that too.
You're like, again, this is going to happen now again.
Yeah.
And it does. So this is, we cut to a month later. She's hanging out, having a chill time watching TV with Mike. They are sort of an item now. Not really. You kind of get the sense that she's closer to Mike for protection.
Mm-hmm.
And that if everyone understands they're an item, she'll be left alone. It's kind of sad because you like that's not a great reason to have a relationship.
Yeah, and it's true. He's not a bad guy, but like
he's not a bad guy, but they don't connect that well.
But I did forget that part. Like I don't know how that she tells him that she was raped, and he doesn't.
You know what?
Her.
I had to reread it twice to see, and the reason why you didn't get it the first time, and I sort of half missed it too, is because I think she is going easy on Mike because Mike will recognize himself in this book, I'm sure, whoever the real Mike is. And so the panel where she says, I was raped, and he says, no, what? No, you were drunk, right? It doesn't show his face. So it's just a word bubble connecting out. And you have to surmise that it's Mike who said that, and it is indeed Mike who said that. So she is visually trying to downplay that.
Yeah. And you can kind of understand as a writer why you'd
choose that when you're writing nonfiction. Do you necessarily want to put people on?
Like the person that was your closest to during that time, you don't want to throw them under the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I was really shocked when I was reading reviews of the book and like articles about the book and like how many didn't mention that she was raped twice or at all in this narrative.
Oh,
like,
interesting.
Like well, they would talk about like misogyny or like sexual harassment or like a general sense of like men being awful and to her, but like they weren't like she was raped twice. Like this seems.
I think that's a deliberate choice though by Kate Beaton, actually.
What is?
That the reviews don't mention that.
Well, that's very true that it does like, it's hard not to focus on that at the expense of everything else. It's true.
Right, and something she said in interviews is that when when an interviewer would make a comment perhaps that was a little too broadly dismissive or critical of these working class men and how she was treated there, she would, her response, a couple of times, she would respond by saying like, that's, like this was just a few people who did this stuff to me, and a lot of men there were nice to me. Vast majority of people there never did anything bad to me, men. But it's obviously the misogyny, the misogynistic atmosphere is so powerful. But she wanted to put, she didn't want to also focus on just, I mean, this suggestion that everybody there are sexual predators.
And that the book is like, men are horrible and stay away from them. But like, I also
or that
think
working
that,
class men are particularly
bad. That's but she does talk about, and I feel like in a really fair and kind of generous way, and like, actually they talked about this on Canada Reads when they the book won. I watched just the last episode of it, but how like the woman or the person who was defending the book was Matea Roach.
The Jeopardy champion.
The Jeopardy champion. And Mateo was talking about how like she's actually really fair to these men and like talks about how like it's kind of like this sociological, like very weird situation to have all these men together, no women, and then there's one woman. Like how are men gonna behave? Like how would you behave? How would your father or your brother behave, you know? Like it's not just that these are terrible people, it's like a very strange situation that they're in.
Yeah.
And this is what it does to them, is create this culture of like, I guess you could say toxic masculinity. But she doesn't try, like, it's not, she's definitely not saying, like, all these men are evil and...
Yeah.
Like, she's definitely not. She's careful not to.
Yes.
And she even has that, like, as you were saying, she even associates, because there's so many Newfoundlanders there, she even kind of has, later in the book, this sort of worry that what if her father was thrown into this kind of situation?
Right, exactly, yeah.
And would he become one of these people, these predators?
Yeah.
Right? And that's a very, I think, illuminating way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. She has that conversation with her sister, Becky, who comes to camp along with, I believe, another friend. So there is some reinforcements arriving to camp. These Becky and her friend are going to work in the office. And when they first arrive, they're not, they don't know what it's like there. They're wearing skirts. So they go to mess hall and they're like, what's going on? Men are literally sticking their heads under the table to look at their legs. And so that's a lesson learned very quickly by the sister Becky. But a nice thing is that Kate finally gets to confide with somebody about what's been going on with her. And so is starting to like understand it and deal with it. And so she actually realizes quite soon that she has to leave Fort McMurray now. So the next section is her moving for 1 year to Victoria. She was trained as a historian. So she gets a job in Victoria at the Maritime Museum of British Columbia. So it's a lovely, it's like, it's an interesting little interlude, and we're quite happy for her. We're like, okay, good, like get out of there. Nice that she's somewhere else. We see an opening scene where she's riding her bike along the water and she's at her job and people are like, you know, they're collegial and making jokes and stuff. And
she's wearing like
city clothes and it's like, you know, it's a museum and they do like high culture fundraising. So she goes to the opera and she's just like learning and having a cultural experience there. But it's a job that pays so little that she has to have a second job. She tries to work at a clothing shop, gets fired when someone says, "Ooh, this sweater's really expensive." And she's like, "Yeah, I know." The boss is like, "Okay, you're fired." And then at a grocery store, a patron is like, "You don't look very happy today." And she's like, "Oh, I'm not, I'm really tired." Apparently that person writes a letter to the boss and also gets Kate fired. So she's really not good at service jobs, which I feel for her there, because that's tough. And and so a friend sees Kate drawing and tells her, you know, you should start a comics website. My friend has one. And so this is the origin story of Kate Beaton's comics career. And there's scenes where we see where she's living. She lives in a tiny room, a studio apartment. There's a mattress on the floor. You know, there's like panels where she opens the door, and it's just this very lonely room. And she's not dating anybody. She tries, but she's clearly still traumatized. And it's not going to last very long there. You know, this is a section where, like, okay, this is like back to the real world. I'm going to have a respectable job. Yeah. And guess what? You can't make enough money doing it.
Yeah. She can't even make a dent in her debt.
That's right. There's a scene where she's on the phone with the student loan people, and they won't give her an extension or an interest relief or anything.
Yeah.
I remember those days too.
Yeah, of course.
Like, oh, you're calling them up and oh yeah. She has to go back to the oil sands. So Kate returns to Fort McMurray from Victoria. She has a much better gig now. She's not living in the camp any longer. She's living actually in a hotel, essentially, for this particular job. It's a kind of hotel or motel, so it's a much more like comfortable living situation, relatively comfortable in town. She also works in an office now. She handles paperwork regarding tools and supplies. And what she's encountering, though, because she's kind of made a step up in a way into the office job, what she's encountering is that a lot of the people she used to work with, the men, are resentful of her now because she's their superior. She asks them, "Where's the paperwork? You need to fill this out." And so she's encountering, again, a different kind of flavor of misogyny where, I'm not going to take orders from this young woman. That's a little bit of the energy there. She's also realizing, now that she handles paperwork, that many of the men who work there are almost illiterate. That is, they can barely fill out a form, some of them. There's a fellow who's named Eugene in the book anyway, who's from Newfoundland, and he is illiterate, and people, the other guys know, and they're making fun of him for it, which is very sad. What's going on here? So her sister Becky is still around, and so they're together they're hanging out a little bit together. This is when the word gets out. This is around 2008, I think. Word gets out about the death of those 500 ducks that we talked about earlier. And so this becomes a New York Times story. They install scarecrows and duck bankers around the tailings pond, and Kate says, like, there's no way this can work. And everyone just understands that this is just something you do for show, to be able to claim that you've done all you can to save any wildlife that might get injured. So I think now we're into this section of the book where, like, there's a sense that Kate is more like she's safe from some of the sexual dangers, or safer than she has been. But there's this sort of emergence of, like, is this, like, actually a safe place to be at all for environmental reasons? She and her coworker are
An ethical place to
be. An ethical place. Yeah. These are questions that start to appear. So her coworker and her talk about how they have a weird rash on their back. And her coworker in the office, another woman, I forget what her name is, she says, "Oh yeah, I've had that I don't know what that is. I've had it for a while." Like, that's not really reassuring. A man has a heart attack while operating a crane. There's an elderly worker, an elderly man who's working there, who is unaware of where he is. He's on his radio in the middle of the road, and Kate is in danger of running him over in her truck. And she's like, this guy's totally unaware of what he is. And so being at that age, working such a dangerous job poses like major physical dangers. And this is where we get the sense that like where the title of the book comes from, Ducks. Well, ducks, obviously the oil sands are dangerous and deadly to ducks. Well, I think everybody there are ducks in their own way. There's a joke here. Her older friend Joe takes her out for lunch because she's having a bad day, and he says the phrase, birds of a feather have to stick together, like twice in a row, trying to get the theme across that yes, all of us are like ducks here.
Can I just add like one thing that Kate Beaton like brings up? I'm not sure in the book, but I think she's trying to allude to it, and she also brings it up in interviews, and like very much stressed this when again on Canada Reads when she won and she got to have like a few minutes.
Oh.
And she talked about how she was also kind of trying to draw attention to the fact that like when all these ducks died in the tailings pond, suddenly this was news. But meanwhile, like the First Nations in Northern Alberta that have like higher incidence of cancer and have been speaking up about this for a long time, like somehow that's not news, but like the ducks, it took these dead ducks to get attention. And so like the actual suffering of human beings seems to not be as interesting somehow in the news cycle.
Yeah, there's a page or two so this is the era of social media. Social media is just starting because it's about 2008. So they're watching YouTube. So you can imagine like how important social media is if you're living in such an isolated life. So there's all these new dynamics, social dynamics start to emerge around social media in the book. Anyway, they're watching a YouTube video of Selena Harp. She's a spokesperson for the Fort McKay First Nation, or is it Mackay? I'm not sure how to say it. Yeah, Fort McKay First Nation, which is along the shores of the Athabasca River. And she's talking about elevated cancer cases among young people. I mentioned online life. So now there's something called Gmail chat. And so there's a guy in the office who, his name's Hatim. He comes over and is like, did you block me on Gmail chat, Kate? And she's like, oh no, I don't think I did. And I don't know. It's not working properly for me or something. Then he walks away and she tells her other coworker, it's like, yeah, I blocked him. He's like, he's been harassing me on Gmail chat. And then we get a panel of the chat and it's like, oh God, it's just like a guy trying to be funny and actually being very offensive.
Like you just walked past my office and la, 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 la.
So a whole other like way to
Why
get
do
harassed.
Why keep walking past my office? Hey? You must want something.
Yeah, she's like, the photocopier's there.
Because of the duck story, there's a lot of interest from the media in Fort McMurray now. A journalist from the Globe and Mail calls Kate and asks her essentially to dish. And Kate doesn't tell her anything. She explains this to her friend why she didn't want to talk to the Globe and Mail journalist about this. Quote, they don't think loneliness and homesickness and boredom and lack of women around would affect their brother or dad or husband the same way. So it's just easy to look over here and say everything is dirty and ugly while she, the journalist, sits in an office in Toronto. She also says, they are still my people, speaking of the East Coast workers there, they are still my people even at their worst. They're more mine than she is, that is the journalist. So an interesting moment where regional identity asserts itself in a very strong way. What else do we, we're getting to the end here. I mean, you know, is there anything else you want to talk about? She has her supervisor, is a big man named Ryan with a beard. He's a nice guy, he's cool, he's nice to Kate. And what happens is we see him fall into drug addiction. So he stops showing up for work. He's talking about kind of staying up late. It's understood that he's probably abusing drugs.
Yeah, it's interesting how the sort of the metaphor of the ducks becomes a larger metaphor for the people on the site, right? And so mental illness and sickness and drug addiction actually starts becoming more and more focused on, not focused on in the book, but I guess the character actually starts being more aware of it, right? And so a lot of the people around her, while they, like for example, Ryan, he started off as a very, very generous kind of fatherly figure, right? And then all of a sudden she starts seeing signs of his, of suicidal ideation or at least that that's hinted at, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very interesting how the ducks and like the poison of the tailing ponds starts kind of seeping into the actual, just the workers, at the laborers.
That's
as
right.
Well.
Yeah. No, you see that's what's happening in this near final section. The worst challenges having been overcome, what's left for Katie to do is to finish paying off her student loans, right? And so indeed, one day she does. She calls her mother and says, I'm broke. And the mom's like, what? It's like, I'm broke because I just spent all my money to pay off my student loans. And the mom's like, oh, that's so wonderful. And then she's like, I think I'm going to become a cartoonist now, mom. And then
mom's like,
oh, Katie. So Katie is getting ready to leave the camp. Her friend Norman is a photographer, gives her this blown up photograph of a rainbow over the site. It's so brutally ironic. They're about to have, she's leaving, they're going to have a company-wide photo. So all the men who work at the site are going to, like hundreds of them, are all going to line up, and they're going to have this like this group photo taken. At this photo session, she meets the man who raped her. He's trying to chat her up. He blithely can't remember her name, or pretends not to, which is clearly a power move. And she's just like, my name's Katie. And he's like, all right, Katie, yeah, anyway, how are things going? And she just doesn't answer, but she's, it's really a poignant scene. Katie's training her replacement, and she finds out that her replacement, a younger woman than her with fewer credentials than her, is already getting paid more than Katie ever got. And she's like, what? And she's also, because she's leaving outside of her contract window, she's leaving as soon as she can, having paid off her debts. She's also having her bonus, a parting bonus, clawed back. So she goes to the a site manager named Gary to complain. And because she has nothing at stake any longer, she's about to leave this job, she just dumps on him. Like, the way that I've been treated here, this woman, like, why is she getting paid more? And it's like, it's insinuated that she knows somebody, she's somebody's daughter or something. That's probably why she easily got a better job. Anyway, and she also talks about how ineffectual their sexual harassment policies are. And in the end, Gary just goes, he's a company man, and he just goes, I'm sorry that was your experience. And he says, in the end, yeah, we'll give you your full bonus. Probably because he was worried that she would go further with some legal action of some sort. I don't know, Gary, we're not sure what to think of Gary. We don't see him for long. So she's back in Cape Breton now. She's back home. This is the denouement of the book. She's a family friend is visiting her father, an older man. He's like, oh yeah, the oil sands are great. Like, I'm gonna go out there and work too. And Katie is just like, comes out of her room and hears the conversation. So, oh, you've been there, Kate? Like, what's it like? You really like it? And she just says, yes, it was good. Because she doesn't want to have to explain it. And maybe he wouldn't understand.
And also, it seems like, and this is, I think this is one of the most amazing parts about Kate Beaton's, like, the subtlety of her narrative constructions.
Yeah.
Is that there seems to be the insinuation that he just doesn't even give her the time to even talk more specifically about this subject because he's a man and he already knows. Yeah. Right? He already knows and is talking like authoritatively about something he doesn't even know, even though that she's lived there.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So she's not going to jump in and be like, actually, like, there's no point at that moment. Yeah.
Yeah. So the very final page is a few pages. She's out with her sister, Becky, some other friends. They're out and about in a real town. Kate is noticing how weird it feels to be out in a normal place. And you think, oh, okay, she's escaped. But she runs into a man who she knew up in the camp.
And Becky did as well.
Yeah. How's it going? Oh, it's good to see you, whatever. This is not a good friend. This is just an acquaintance. He said, oh yeah, you know, the guys loved you so much, you know, back talking of the sister Becky. We all had thinking this is funny, we all had a competition to see like who could sleep with you first. And then
Becky just laughs.
Just laughs like, oh, and goes, really? Oh, well, okay, so good to see you. See you later. And then the other women of the friend group go, what was that? Why did you let him
talk to you
speak
like that,
that way to you? And here we are, the ghost of this sort of misogyny.
And that's the end.
That's the very end. Yeah. So the ghost of this experience like haunts them still. So that is the end of this wonderful book, Ducks. We've already mentioned there's an afterword too that tries to explain some of the themes, but we don't really need to say too much about that. I guess this is the moment for questions from the audience. What do you think?
Yeah.
If anybody has any questions or comments, feel free to come up to the microphone.
Right there.
Thanks.
I have a question. Does the book offer a critique about the student loan system, like the that impoverishes so many new graduates?
I think it's just implied. Like I was saying at the beginning, it's very much implied. Like we were joking about how our parents all thought that a degree was going to get us a job. I mean, the reason they thought that was because a degree got them a job, and when they got one, or would have if they had, right? Like yeah. People like it. Things have changed in a way where, like, actually getting an undergrad degree, like, in you know, like, what's the word? Screws you.
Well put.
But I feel like the book doesn't dwell on that, and it's not something that people really talk about when they talk about the book. But it's so important.
Yeah.
I guess I have a question that's sort of related to the commentary just now, but it strikes me that end line that she has, that she says, "Mom, I'm broke, so I'm coming home." And then the conversations before with people saying, you know, don't spend all your money, but people just buying all these material goods. And it seems that there's this sense of like money being earned, but no wealth created and no wealth to bring out, you know? Yeah. So I wonder if there's anything that sort of comments on that throughout, or implicitly or explicitly, I don't know.
It's more implicit. It's kind of like the student loan thing again. Like it's shown, but not, you know, really. Yeah, there's not a lot of exposition about it.
It comes up here and there. I mean, yeah. There was that conversation among the Newfoundlanders I was talking about earlier. The old guys, like, don't spend your money. They're like, leave us alone.
Yeah, and yeah. The whole, like, you think you're going to go there for 2 years and come back. But, I mean, that's why people get stuck there, is because they spend all the money.
It's tragic. I mean, there's a tragic element to that kind of story where you go somewhere to make money, and what you do is you just stay there making money and spending money, but living a life someplace you didn't want to be.
But then there's
living
also
a life you never planned to live.
Yeah.
So there's a tragedy in that. There's a tragic
element to
that. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then there's also like the men that are sending money home to their wives.
Yes.
Yeah. But like they never see their wives and children.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And it's supposed to be temporary, but like it goes on and on.
And the strain, and it's mentioned, we don't really get it depicted so much, but it's mentioned how many people get divorced while they're there. And you can imagine like you've ruined. You were there, going there supposedly to support your family, and now you've ruined your family to do it. I mean, that's again like the tragic element to this. Oh yeah, thanks.
I have a quick question. Any comments on what's going on up there right now? So Imperial Oil's basically trying to use a contractor to squeeze some of the service workers in one of the big camps and reduce their hourly wage by $7 an hour. Meanwhile, there's been the huge, huge oil spill up there that is, you know, causing wildlife to die, and also is a huge health potential. And then that's not to, you know, there's always oil spills up there. But those are the two ones that are really in the news right now, and just wanted to know if...
Yeah, there was an article today, a friend of the pod, Rona, sent us an email with a link to an article that came out this morning on CBC about... animal, like wildlife being found dead around the tailings ponds again.
Right. What I've been thinking about recently with the recent jump in oil prices, how oil production there continues to grow. This every year is the biggest year in terms of oil production. But I mean, I think it's gone down depending on what the prices are. But this year, last year was the biggest. They produced the most oil they've ever have. But you'll notice that the number of people being employed to work there is actually going down now. And so when there is, so even the arguments about this kind of oil extraction, how destructive it may be, how damaging, the arguments have been, well, you know, it creates good jobs. You know, working men and women can make a good living doing this. But that's increasingly not the case. Less and less so is that the case, because these jobs are being automated away. And also once a site is built, it requires much fewer people to operate it. So after, since so much has been done there already, like they require fewer and fewer people to actually work there. So they're actually employing the same amount of people as they did in 2006, even though they're producing way, 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 way more oil. So that's a trend that is disheartening for even like at least some of what we'd call the benefits of this, which is at least some wealth goes to workers. There's going to be less and less of that.
Yeah, I was struck so much by how much of what you were talking about, the workers in Fort Mac related, it sounded exactly like my project about migrant workers from around the world coming to Canada, abandoning home for opportunity, having doing what's best for their family, but in the end, kind of their family being destroyed by the work that they're doing. But that's not what I wanted to ask. What I wanted to ask was, for all of you and all of us who live in Calgary, and like you said, the very beginning, oil sands, Fort McMurray talk has been with us for decades. Was there anything in this book that surprised you hadn't heard before? You know, because I think other than the art of it and the craft of it and her personal story, nothing that you've talked about, I haven't read the book yet, but nothing that you've talked about so far on the panel is stuff that I don't think would surprise any of us in Alberta.
Right.
But I'm wondering, was there something in there that did surprise you?
I think what surprised me, and actually my sister talks about, so I gave this book to my sister as a Christmas present, because after I purchased it and then I read a little bit of it, I was like, oh my God, this book, I need to give it to my sister. Because I think it articulates an experience that she, like very few people have, right? As a woman living in these types of situations. And one of the things that she said that was surprising about the book was that it doesn't actually vilify Alberta. Which is, if you think about it, but there is actually even a scene in the book where people from Newfoundland are actually talking about how terrible this place is, how terrible Alberta is. And then one of the people who lives there and has lived in Alberta all their lives kind of steps up and is like, why don't you go back home, right, if you don't like it here? And it's, Kate Beaton doesn't actually make a comment on that. She just shows the sort of the feeling of insult that this person has, the feeling of displacement that these people have, and then the reaction to that. And she tries very much, and I think she successfully does this, to show the beauty of these spaces, right? And I think that was the most surprising, how these spaces are eerie, beautiful, sublime, as you said. Right? I think that was probably the most surprising thing for me.
Yeah, like she's really not, and I mean, she says this in her afterword, like in case you missed it, like she's really not trying to vilify anyone, like whether that's, well, except for like the men who personally attacked her. But like in terms of like, you know, men or Alberta or even the oil sands or the oil industry, like she's really not trying to like, take any one of those and say this is evil. She's just trying to show the complexity of the situation.
Yeah,
really.
And
go ahead.
I was going to say, she, as I already quoted her at length talking about her regional affiliations and how important it was knowing other Cape Bretoners there and how that provided a sense of support and community to her. And that is a really important part of identity. I mean, I think she understands that that's a regional experience for many different regions in Canada, including Alberta. And how, say, a Toronto journalist doesn't represent that very well, doesn't understand that very well, which... we understand that, you know, being in Alberta, we understand the way that this place sometimes gets represented by people who don't understand it, aren't from here. I mean, that is an experience of anybody who lives in some place that isn't like central Canada, essentially. So as someone from a region, she understands, I think, the experience of people from another region in that way. So that scene, you're right. She doesn't comment on it, but I think she wanted to give that man's argument some weight, actually. Yeah. So... any final thoughts on the book? I don't have any. I feel like I've said everything.
One other thing that she says about the title is that that like it's kind of a metaphor, like migrants, right? Like they're migrating birds, and
right,
they
yeah,
are
right.
mired in oil and can't get out. And it's this like, to her, like really obvious metaphor for like the migrant worker from, you know, inside Canada, but very far away, and who ends up stuck and kind of poisoned by this environment. So I just wanted to add that.
Any final thoughts, Mark?
Nope. I think that we've said everything. But yeah, it's just an amazing book. If you want to like a real easy way of getting into Kate Beaton's work, like Hark a Vagrant is just so funny. And it really appeals to people who love like literature and history. And it's like has so many funny kind of like anecdotes about Austin and the Victorian era and medieval era. And it just jumps around in that kind of European sphere, and very, very funny, very clever. I really like Kate Beaton.
Yeah, I mean, it's very literary. That she writes about literary characters, fictional characters.
Bronte sisters, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really wonderful. Okay, well, I want to thank everybody here for coming. Thank you, Mark, for being a wonderful guest. Thank you to the Calgary Public Library. And we'll see you next time.